you with hearts that are so grateful for all the blessings you give us. We ask that you guide us in our work. We ask that you protect those who put their lives on the line so that we're free to do the public's work. God be with our citizens, keep them in good health. Keep our county a good county to raise a family and to worship you. We ask that you forgive us when we sin, when we forget that you are God, and that you do have a purpose for each of us. We ask that you give us the guidance to live within that purpose. In all that you do, we ask that you always keep your love in our hearts. In your Son's name we pray. Amen. Amen.
Again, good morning. We will start the agenda with Dr. Terry Royer. Terry, morning.
Before I start, I'd like to acknowledge all the agency directors and other mental health professionals in the community who came out today to support our request for the placement of a levy on the November ballot.
How many are here? Show of hands. Thank you for coming.
Okay, I'm going to read a prepared statement. It won't be too long and hopefully not too painful. On November 17, 2006, the Mental Health Board voted unanimously to adopt a resolution requesting the County Commission to place a five-year, one-mill tax levy on the November 2006 election ballot. The mental health system in Butler County is in a state of crisis. The crisis is real, and it's right now. All over Butler County, persons of all ages with a mental illness are finding it increasingly difficult to receive the services they need. Sadly, the problem is going to get worse without this levy. This time next year or earlier, the mental health system will be faced with a task of once again reducing funding to an already fragile system of care. The federal and state funding we've received has declined over the past decade, and board reserves have been depleted. So we have no choice but to continue cutting services. We are projecting that we will have to reduce funding to our contract agencies by an additional $1.8 million. The effect will be truly disastrous. The board's current one-half mil levy was originally passed in 1985 and has been renewed twice. The same one-half mil levy today, if passed, would generate $3.75 million. However, the effective rate of our current one-half mil levy generates only $2.2 million. In other words, the Mental Health Board has not had an increase in local funding in 21 years. In 1985, when the voters of Butler County approved our existing levy, the population of Butler County was approximately 270,000 people. Today, the population of Butler County stands at an estimated 350,000. 80,000 more people who are living, working, attending school in Butler County than in 1985. This is a nearly 30% increase in population with virtually no increase in local mental health funding. The Mental Health Board has placed a levy on the ballot 9 times since 1985, yet since that time we have not passed a levy to increase our local funding. After 21 years under the original levy, the Butler County Mental Health Board is unable to maintain, let alone expand, needed services to meet today's demand for affordable and accessible mental health services. Over the past 4 years, the Mental Health Board has reduced funding to service providers by $2.5 million. Today, after years of cuts, the Mental Health Board is essentially a Medicaid-only board for mental health services. This means that significant segments of the county's population, including those who are often referred to as the working poor, and others who may have little or no health insurance, are not able to receive our services. Over the years, Butler County Mental Health Board has worked hard to stretch its funding, improve operating efficiencies, and ensure that taxpayers' dollars are being spent wisely and effectively on meeting the mental health needs of our community. Last year, which ended June 30th, the Butler County Mental Health Board received $373,000 in state safety net funds. Yet it still had to cut services by $150,000. For the current fiscal year, the Mental Health Board has been approved to receive an additional $750,000 of safety net funds. We've received more than our fair share of these funds and are greatly concerned that they will not be available in the future. The proposed one mill levy would generate approximately $7.5 million a year and cost the owner of a $100,000 house about 59 cents a week or less than a dime a day. This money will be spent to restore needed services to an array of our county's citizens, including children and their families, our increasing aging population, returning soldiers who are suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, and other critically needed treatment services for our many mentally disabled citizens. We do not take for granted the generosity of the public. We recognize that asking voters to self-impose any increase in taxes is a serious matter. We ask voters to consider carefully our request and the proposition that an effective mental health system is beneficial to the safety and well-being of our community. On behalf of the Butler County Mental Health Board, I wish to thank the Board of County Commissioners for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. Yes.
Doctor, I don't know if there's any press here today or not, but could you make sure that the various agencies get that, the media?
Absolutely.
I definitely want to pledge my support for whatever we can do to help.
Mike, do you have any comments?
Yeah, I agree with Commissioner Furman. Please get that message out, and anything I think we can do to help in that regard, we'll do it. Conversations with our folks at the ODGFS or Workplace Human Services, department of many names. One of the biggest challenges we have in getting families back to work is mental health issues. Right. And same thing in our jail, a large part of our population, the deinstitutionalization that occurred, this is what I call do-gooding run amok. The lawsuits that were filed beginning in the 70s to deinstitutionalize a lot of the state institutions, while certainly well-intended and having done a lot of good, basically pushed a large portion of mentally ill, seriously mentally ill, into two places. One is the homeless, which Councilman Becker works with every day, and the other is we've criminalized mental illness, which is a shame.
Absolutely.
A lot of these people and the families that are affected, if they just take their medications, what a difference their lives would be. But you have to have somebody out there managing the case and intervening and doing the work. And if the public just really understood the effect that this has, not just on the individuals, but on the families that have to endure those problems, and the financial strains, the emotional stress, the living hell that they go through. If we could communicate the reality of that experience, and then finally the effect on our community. There are people alive today that will not be alive probably at the end of this year, or tragically, certainly in the life cycle of funding, who will be maimed or killed because someone has gone untreated, and that mental illness has just reached a break point where it results in a tragedy, and oftentimes it's somebody, it's a complete stranger that's never met them. And so there's clearly a need, and it's so much of it, if there is intervention, that's to me one of the greatest tragedies. If if there are, if we put the resources in place to provide those interventions and supports for the families. Another area is children that are abused. A very large portion of the children that come into our child support, Children's Services Agency, are neglected mainly and put in danger because of the debilitating mental state of the parent. The last child that we had that died in Butler County in the Middletown fire was primarily the result of a mother who was mentally ill, untreated, and ended up burning the trailer and killing her little baby with it. And so anything we can do to communicate the reality of what that world is like and what the real need is, you don't have to say vote for the levy. You just need to tell the story of what services are being provided and to whom and why and how that benefits the community. And then I think people that read that will naturally know this is a program worthy of support. So anything I can do to be helpful, I'd be happy to do.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you. And I'd just like to echo my sentiments also to support. I've been a supporter of mental health levies for a number of years and worked on campaigns and, again, offer my assistance in that. In the fact that has been documented, the needs are definitely there. But the other message that needs to be brought home to the citizens of Butler County is that you've been good stewards of tax dollars and will continue to be. And so please feel free to call on myself or the rest of the commission for help with this levy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Need a motion? We need move to approve. Also, I'd like to make a motion that we have a resolution of support if that's necessary to go with that.
Second.
Commissioner Fox?
Yes.
Commissioner Furman?
Yes.
Commissioner Gallaudet?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good luck.
Thank you.
And thank you all for coming.
Thanks. Okay. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I think we're going to delay the Ohio Homeland Security just for one second, if you don't mind. We have another issue that
I was going to get it off of there for you.
Oh, that's all right. You can leave it.
Dorothy Keith and Alan Daniels, you want to? Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for allowing me to be here. I'm very nervous.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
We have an intersection on Howell Road and Mosman Road in West Middletown. There is currently a traffic light there. However, when you're trying to turn left off of Howell Road onto Mosman Road, there is a little hill there, and you cannot see if there's oncoming traffic. I feel this is an accident waiting to happen. I've been told nothing will be done because we have not had any deaths at this intersection. I think it's a shame that we wait until there is a serious accident before something would be done. There is a traffic light there. I am petitioning, and I have signatures of residents in the area that would like to have a left turn signal put there. If we cannot have a left turn signal put there, could we alternate the traffic light so that it's not green at the same time on all three on all the sides? Maybe just have it green whenever you're turning left, then you don't have to worry if there's a vehicle coming over that hill that you cannot tell if there's anything coming. I do have had several residents tell me that they wait when they're turning left until the traffic light turns red before they will turn because they are scared to turn. And so we have citizens that are actually breaking the law for their own safety because they're concerned of a car coming over this little hill. And that's pretty much it.
Right now there's a light there now, but there it just doesn't have a left turn signal.
That is correct.
Have you talked to the engineer's office?
I did receive a phone call from I didn't bring his name. Do you remember who called me?
Greg Wilkins.
And he said they are checking into it. But again, he told me that most of the red lights are done according to the number of accidents that are there. And our township has grown, as well as the Trenton area. And a lot of residents from Trenton do use this road to get to Middletown now.
But I can understand that, putting a light, but there's a light already there. So it's just a matter of changing it to one that has a left turn signal.
Exactly. That is what we're requesting. The petition that I have also does request that the hill be leveled, but I do understand that that is a major expense. If we could get something to done with the traffic light, I think it would help the situation, and your township residents would be happy with
just
that.
Just in time.
He said he'd be here.
Yeah.
That's it.
Another problem, and if you're coming east on Howell Road and you're going to turn left on Mosman and you're pulling a trailer, the hill is extreme and the traffic count. We've talked to Greg about this three times in my terms as a township trustee. But our road crew have gotten caught a couple times. If a car's coming over, we'll say 45 to 50 mile an hour, and you're turning left and you're in the right of way and you don't see a car, when the tail end of your trailer can get hit. And she's telling the truth about there are people, and we've talked about it in a couple of our meetings. People will turn illegally because they know that it's red on the other side, and they can see as you go up the hill, but they can turn left. And in the same token, there hasn't been any accidents, and Greg can verify that. One of our trustees in the past, it was a deputy sheriff, and he was in part of his responsibilities was wrecks, and there's not very many wrecks there, but there has been a lot of almost wrecks. Possibly if the signal would be red and green on the left where you could go ahead and turn, I don't know if you call that a delay or whatever, I'm not up on that, but what she's stating is exactly true, and it's been brought to our, like I said, to our meetings, I'm going to say three times in the last 15 years, and the reports come back the same, but I think she's got a valid request, and any help that the county commissioners can do, we greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. Yes, that'd be happy to. Greg, do you want to address this?
You know, I missed what she said, but I think I know the gist of it. I don't think anyone in this room or anyone who's ever driven the intersection could argue that there's potential there. There's absolutely no doubt there's potential. But the reality of it, statistically, is, as we said, it isn't a high-ranking intersection. Matter of fact, in the whole scope of things, in pure accidents, just number of accidents, it probably ranks 212th in the county. And statistically, when you put the volume of traffic, so you can rank heavily traveled intersection with rural intersection, don't get that much traffic. So you get them on a percentage basis to put them on an even keel, it ranks about 109th. In all our intersections. And it quite honestly, it's just a matter of dollars. You know, if you put those type of intersections to fix the vertical, to fix that, you're approaching $750,000.
What they're requesting is just to change a light from a... You're talking about leveling
I'm talking about typically if we go to an intersection, a lot of times if you put a turn lane in, you got to have a turn lane width. Unless you split phase the intersection. If you put an arrow, you usually got to put a turn lane with it, or else you split phase it. And we can split phase that, and we are looking at short-term fixes for this thing to help them. We're not discounting all that. We're going to take a look at that, the potential of three-way stops and all the other things to stop. But for every action, there's a reaction. And what concerns us is the vertical is bad enough that you got the potential for rear end. Of the five accidents that's happened in the last 10 years, only two of them, amazing enough, and this was surprising to me, was where a person was turning and somebody like T-boned them. The rest of them were rear end, or they just ran. They stopped and ran a stop sign. And that's just that human error factor that it seems to be getting worse as time goes on in this county, and I think around the nation. I think people are less attentive when they're driving. I think they're busy, their minds are other things, and I think we're seeing a rash of that. You know, as we all know, statistics this year are up. Going back to the dollars, if you figure, you know, at 109, if this is 109th ranked, and we spend all our money, our capital improvement, now what I'm saying, our capital improvement budget from the engineer's office is about $6 to $7 million a year is what we spend on pure capital improvements. We'll double that up and say, let's say we spend 12, I find matching money. You know, we're talking 7 years out to fix something like that. 7 or 8, and that's saying, that understanding, that's saying I'm not going to do any capacity intersections. No capacity. No Cincinnati Dayton roads, none of the other where we know we got the major problem. No bridge work. Absolutely no bridges. We're just going to focus all on intersections. That's the reality that we're faced every day. I mean, that's the reality of dealing with the budget and dealing with the other things and setting priorities. Because it's our desire to fix them all, you know. And the other thing we're running into, you're going to find that a lot of the intersections we're having are rural, are old county road, state roads, and not the interstate, but the money is funneling to the interstate system, the federal money, the bulk of the money. And that's because volume. And they funnel it there. But statistically across the nation, it's the county and the rural system that has the greatest amount of fatalities in it. We are trying to work on that, and the County Engineers Association is working on that nationally in an effort to get more money funneled back to the rural system, what we say is a rural system. It could be the urban areas that we designate the urban areas of liberties and union, but also in the areas like Raleigh. That was one of the high ranking that we're just finishing right now is Pearson and Stillwell Beckett. We've taken that major curve out. So we statistically analyze this on an ongoing basis and in reference to fix that. We're going to look at see what we can do short term on this. The radius problem is going to be a major obstacle in here, but we can look at something that's split phase of signal. And anytime you talk a signal improvement anymore, that's $100,000. When just talking just pure signal, you know, and the cure, everyone thinks the cure all is a fix with signals. For every action, there's a reaction. Signals are not a cure-all to everything. Not just this situation, but I'm talking across the board. Because I statistically tell you, when you put a signal up, and in the early part of that signal, you're going to get rear-end collisions. That's statistically proven time and time and time again. So, and we catch a lot of that in our office, that just put a signal. It fixes all. That isn't always the case. We're going to look at this one. We'll look at some stop sign options, three-way stops, potentially split phasing if we revamp the signal. That is, interesting enough, that I think is the first signal ever placed in rural Butler County, is at this intersection. It's been up, I think, since mid-60s sometime. First signal now, I think we're probably got over 80 signals in the county we're responsible for, and that was the very first one. So we're going to take a look at it. I'm not going to make any idle promises. I don't do that unless we'll look at it and see what we can do. And take it under advisement.
Mr. President?
Yes.
In today's engineering, that would never been okay to put that intersection.
No.
In that
matter of fact, it really doesn't meet warrants.
Right.
It's just been grandfathered in. We left it there. It doesn't meet any signal warrants. We'd never put that signal up today.
Yeah.
Mike?
Yeah. Tell me, Greg, about the rear end issue. If you either stop signed it, or because I'm guessing there's not a lot of volume.
No.
So if, let's say that rather than having two-way greens, what if you just sequentially just make it a three-way stoplight, and then in other words, you've got at any one time two directions at a red light, and then only one movement.
You know, but statistically saying, remember I told you there was 5 accidents out here?
Mm-hmm.
2 of them were failure to yield. So the stop sign isn't the ultimate answer, but we'll look at it. The only thing that concerns me with the stop sign, we'd have to put some advanced warning, because if you know that crest comes over pretty quickly, and you're blinded coming into that intersection. So the good thing is we don't have a lot of traffic. So you don't have them backing up where they just come right over the hill and right there's a car.
But that risk you have already.
That
they come over that hill and there's a red light.
That is correct.
So you haven't increased the risk of that occurring.
Right.
As you said, by today's standards, they may not have even...
No.
Just because of the geography or geometry of the thing, it's just
right.
There's no good solution until you spend the big money to spend
the big money
out.
Which is going to be three quarters to $1 million.
The practical problem, and Greg is in a very difficult position, because it doesn't make sense that let's wait till somebody dies to move it up the list, but practically speaking, you have to have some standard to go by, and the fact that you do have fatalities, you do have higher volumes of accidents, you do have higher volumes of traffic and so forth, that's the fairest way to allocate scarce resources. Nobody's come up with a better way to do it. But it seems to me, and on just the signal change, if you just had that sequential, since there isn't a lot of traffic, since the people that use that are primarily locals, and the real risk is where you have a local and a non-local meet at
yes.
the same intersection.
Yes.
Because the non-local is not aware of the risk.
And I think that's the benefit of this. I think most of the people trailing this intersection are local. You probably got some minor out of town headed to Weatherwax Golf Course or something. But I think that's why you see statistically this intersection's low in accidents. I think people are aware of it or caution when they approach it. And I think that's the difference we run into in a rash of fatalities we've had in the eastern part of the county. I don't think we've got a lot of people that are not this familiar with the surroundings and stuff. And
now, would that, if they took the signal and made it red, and just only at any one time you've only got one lane moving, would that be acceptable to you all? Now, when you talked about $100,000 fix and so forth, would even something like that cost, assuming you put, you know, stop ahead or whatever it is.
Yeah, because you're going to have to put advanced detection in that situation. You have to put loops to make it detected so it changes. And you got some, and you're going to be in a neighborhood. Anytime you start looking at the signal, you're $75,000 to $100,000. That's just the nature of the beast.
When you say advanced detection, so it can tell the light that
right.
somebody's coming?
Right, they can tell the light and put the stop condition on. Because you're going to leave it, it's going to be prorated green to some movement. And that's probably the east-west movement, I'm thinking. Just to let that move and actuate that, that'd be the predominant.
Could you fix it just to rotate and not have prorated
movement? You'd want it on call so it can stop. One movement's going to be a predominant, you know, when nobody's there, it's going to be green to some movement. Or else otherwise, and a cheaper fix is stop signs. You put three stop signs in. That way, and
I was just going to say, if you had
that way, you got every movement, and it isn't a capacity problem, which is a good thing.
Right.
That you can stop everybody, you stop everybody for that movement. That's not to say it's going to be a cure-all, because as I said, statistically, even with the red light, people have the potential, and I don't think you can put the stop signs up without putting a red flashing sign up, so people
right.
know that you're going to have to stop there.
Have you thought about the stop sign option with the red flashing?
Since when you pull from Osmond, you go toward Trenton, when you pull up there, it's automatic. It'll change on you. I mean, it's set that way. The reason it's set this way in Grego is because the biggest flow is from Trenton Franklin. It's a crossover road is what it is. People come from Trenton or even from 73. They'll cross over and they go to the other side of Middletown, go to West Middletown, Trenton Franklin, up to Route 4. It's a crossover, and there's, like you said, there's not a whole lot of volume, but that's what it's mainly used for, and of course the residents in that area. But if you did put three stop signs, you would definitely, which I think there's a sign already when you're coming west on Howell Road. Is there a sign of, there is none?
No, not headed. No, west there is. Headed west there is, yes. West there
is. I thought there was.
Yeah, west.
So
west and south on Mossum.
It would just be, I don't know what you call them, the rebel strips across the road where you, and it notifies people. We have it on Jacksonburg Road. There's a lot of accidents at 73 in Jacksonburg. That's notorious.
They've got like six sets of those rascals, and they'll get your attention. Take, you know, you might be running 60, but you'll get your attention. You hit five of those. But it would just be, like Greg said, it would be a learning experience. It'd be a time element for people to get used if they did put three stop signs up.
Three stop signs with flashing red.
Especially on,
yeah,
mainly
you need
on
a flashing red.
Yeah.
Combined with the rumble strips?
Well, I'm just made a comment because
I know the rumble strips have been an issue.
The rumble strips, I tell you what, you know, for every action is a reaction. The general public in that area and the neighbors, you're going to find. You've got to bring the neighbors on board. With the ones you've seen on Jacksonburg, the trustees have worked with those for like 6 months before and understood the residents because they create noise in the middle of the night and there's no stopping it. And what we found where we put them in previously and taking them back out is the neighbors who just went crazy over them because of the noise.
That was the reason I brought that up was because I come down that way. So. And that just made me, and I do know there's been a lot of accidents at 73 in Jacksonburg Road. That's the tourist. Yeah. But any help that can be assisted to the residents and also the whoever goes through our roads, we greatly appreciate it.
And we are looking into it.
Well, thank you. You have anything else that you'd like to add? Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming, and thank you, Greg,
okay.
As always. Okay. Mr. Crank, would you like to address us? Welcome to our meeting.
Thank you. Just got back from California, so I'm still not out of bed yet.
Yeah.
At no expense to the county, I might add.
Yeah.
I am here today to address issue number 45. Award contract 606060 Integrated Land Records System to COT. I'll be rather brief. We have been with a company called ACS since 1987, had a very good working relationship with ACS. About 3 years ago, we went out for bid, first time since 1987 that we went out for a new records contract. When I received that contract back, we saved the county about $50,000 a year with that contract. Through Denise Gall's work, for the past year, we've been working on going out for other bids this year. We have traveled to state looking at other systems at no cost to the county, I might add, on our own. And we did go out for an RFP. And we decided, through a lot of work and a lot of study, to go with a new system called COT, which is an Ohio company. That contract is going to save the county about $155,000 over a three-year period. Which you'll be addressing today. I just wanted you to know the cost savings, and we have done a lot of research on the COT system. We feel bad that we're leaving ACS after so many years of a good relationship, but we look for a good relationship with the COT industry, and the only problem we're going to have, I guess, that we're concerned with is conversion from COT to ACS. It's going to take us at least 6 months, but I think that's going to be a good system for the county, and it's going to be a nice cost savings to us. Over the three-year period, about $155,000 at least. So I just wanted to give my two cents. I wanted to thank Denise publicly for all the work she's done on this. She's the one that put the RFP together and has been with me every time we look at other systems throughout the state. And I just wanted to come and say that. You'll be addressing it later on today, but it will be a nice cost savings to the county.
Thank you. Chuck?
Danny, I'd just like to express our appreciation because I know you've always been a team player. And you always look at ways to cut your budget, and that means an awful lot to the county.
Great.
And we appreciate your hard work and that of your staff and Denise. It definitely doesn't go unnoticed.
Great.
We really
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
We always work for the taxpayers of the county. We always remember that, and that's what we strive for, okay? Thank you very much now.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks, Denise. Why don't we do communications? Why don't we do communications first, you know, if you want to.
All right. Approve travel and training. Approve three-day suspension. Move Jonathan Turner, bailiff, from part-time to full-time.
Thanks,
hire,
Greg.
Hire court aide for Erie 3 Court. Grant promotion. Delora Messer, mailroom. Grant extension of health care benefits. Approve five child care personnel actions. Care facility actions. Cancel sidewalk performance bond for Union Center, Commerce Park, Phase 1. Receive and refer bids for contract 2M 16 and 14. grant special hauling permit for to Bruck Excavating, cancel maintenance bond for Union Center Commerce Park, two phase threes, award contract for east paving of various county roads, exchange sidewalk bond for Foxborough Phase 1C, exchange performance bond for maintenance bond for Foxborough Phase 1C, set hearing date for stormwater management in Liberty Township under Environmental Services, approve and execute contract 3-C8 with Armel Burns Company, award contract to United Survey Incorporated for Mulhauser State Route 747 sewer rehab, approve extension of public water and sewer services to Harbor Town Park Section 1, approve and execute contract with United Survey, receiving for bids for mobile recycling and sewer line replacement, approve extension of public sanitary sewer services to Lesordsville Westchester Road, amend two resolutions, release one-year maintenance bond for Walden Pond Section 9, authorize reimbursement for Sunset Point for oversizing, hire wastewater operator 2 under finance, approve transfers and appropriations for care facility, approve amended certificate of estimated resources dated June 29th. Under Job and Family Services, approve a contract with Hamilton City Schools, approve three child daycare contracts, accept and place on file employee payroll for June 10th through 23rd, poll number 37 for more information. Under miscellaneous, advertise for bids for a photograph and imaging system, approve agreement with Summit County and Erie County for imaging contract, also an imaging contract with Washington County, approve reimbursement for meeting on Workforce 1, approve memorandum of understanding with Butler County Children's Service Board, approve revisions to OKI bylaws, award contract for integrated land record system to COT Systems, approve and execute release of funds for certification for CDBG. You're right, Commissioner, we have that on there. And enter upon journal annexation petition of land into the City of Oxford.
Is there a motion?
Move to approve.
Second.
Commissioner Fox?
Yes.
Commissioner Furman?
Yes.
And Commissioner Jolivet?
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Tom Horse from Homeland, Ohio Homeland Security. Yes. Welcome.
Thank you.
Sorry we kind of moved you around on the agenda.
No problem whatsoever.
Nice to meet you.
Good luck, Mike.
There's three different folders.
Okay.
That's a set.
Well, this is, oh, okay.
Mr. Conklin has about four handouts for you there that he'll pass out to you. First off, I want to thank you for letting me address you this morning on behalf of Kenneth Merkel, the director, and John Overly, the executive director of Ohio Homeland Security. And give you a little background, I'm in my 32nd year in law enforcement. I had three terms as sheriff in Highland County. I was elected there in 88, 92, and 96. I left there in 99, went to work for the Attorney General's office and set up your statewide sex offender registry that you use today at the sheriff's office to track the sex offenders. So that's what I've been doing until I landed this position with Homeland Security. What I'm here today to talk to you about is just a buy-in from the commissioners and let you know what we're doing. And it's basically on the two things. One is SIMS, the Contact Information Management System, which you have a little handout on. And that's a system that you can receive information. We'll tell you what that information's about. And the other is on the SAC, which is the Strategic Analysis Information Center, which is the intelligence gathering side of Homeland Security. We work with all entities, and one of the things we work with is commissioners through your emergency management director, the sheriff, police chiefs, and those type of things. So what we have, if you can see the presentation behind you, I don't know if you can or not where you're setting, but
he's on.
No, it's not going through our system. Okay.
Ohio's broken into 8 districts. Down here in Butler County, you fall into Region 6. My territory that I take care of takes in everything in the brown. So I have 22 counties in southwest Ohio that I'm responsible for, Butler County being one. I go all the way up to Union County, Dark, and eventually they say I'm going to take over Mercer, Allglaze, Shelby, and Logan also. So
working with the agencies within those areas. The Strategic Analysis Information Center is located in Columbus in the basement of the Emergency Management Center. We have a SAC structure. We have the infrastructure, which is all private and public infrastructure here in the state of Ohio, headed up by Bill Vedra, who's the retired, one of the retired fire chiefs from Columbus. We have investigations with his Rich Rollins, who is retired ATF. He was third in line at ATF when he retired. And we have National Guard, the Seaburn Group's Advisory Council, and our analytical group. The SAC is run under Ohio Homeland Security, as I said. It's a group of local, county, state, federal, and private sector agencies working as a team. In the past, we've not worked as a team in Ohio. We have sort of decentralized law enforcement. Ohio has 913 law enforcement agencies, and we've never all been on the same page. We are working on that and getting everyone in the same mindset, collecting the same type of information and getting it to the analytical group so we know what's going on. The pictures you're looking at there come from the bombings last year, actually year ago tomorrow over in London, July 7th of 05. We want to establish, which we have, a secure collection and analysis and fusion sensitive of this information. So the collection part comes from the public. It comes from the private and public sectors that we get information back to the SAC so we can analyze it. The other side of the coin is the timely sharing of this information. That's where SIMS comes in, where information can be put out to the county commissioners, the sheriffs, EMA directors, any agency that needs it. We'll have that information immediately by the internet on the SIMS network, get it back to you. So we want to get you guys, make sure you're signed up. We did send an invitation to Larry Long to get that information out to the county commissioners, so each and every one of you will be aware of it. Pictures here again come from the bombings in London. That's the double-decker bus in the background, and we'll talk a little more about that, how that impacts Ohio. We want to develop a partnership with the private sector agencies, and again, working with your emergency management director, the sheriff, the police chiefs, fire chiefs, and yourselves, I would like to be invited to other meetings through your organization, such as your Rotary Club, your Chamber of Commerce, and those type of things. Rather than Tom Horst going out and saying, here I am, I want to talk to you, I'd rather go on your behalf and talk to them about Homeland Security and what they can do to help us be better prepared here in Ohio to protect our public. Again, the pictures come from the bombings last year in London. The top picture was taken actually on July 8th of last year, a day after the bombing, and that was taken at 9:05 in the morning. 9:05 in the morning, that train car should have been packed with people, but unfortunately it wasn't due to the bombing the day before. We work with the Seaburn Groups, which is chemical, biological, nuclear, the radiological, and explosives. We have the Ohio Department of Health, the Ohio EPA, EMA, EMS, and the Ohio Department of Agriculture. All of those agencies have analysts that are setting and investigators setting in the SAC that are working with each other on a daily basis with the information we get from the public and from the private sector. We also have the infrastructure, which takes in, as I said, all the infrastructure in the state of Ohio, private and public. We have the private corporations, the advisory council, our legal if we need it, the Transportation Securities Administration from the federal side, and the Ohio Department of Transportation. They have an agent that works in our office monitoring all the roadways in Ohio and all the conditions of the roadways. So if something happens there of a terrorist nature or catastrophe, we know about it immediately and we can get information back out to where it needs to go. We have the investigative side, which takes in all of these agencies. And again, they have full-time people working there. BCI has assigned someone there. Columbus Police Department has four sergeants they've assigned to the SAC that are working there on a daily basis, right down to the sheriff's offices, ATF, Secret Service. We also have the U.S. Marshals and the FBI. Islamic terrorist elements in the United States as of the end of 05, most of them are east of the Mississippi River. Most of them have settled there. We have in Ohio two very active regions, one of them being Cleveland, one of them being Columbus, and that is with the Muslim Brotherhood. Just up the road in Detroit, we have Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and the Muslim Brotherhood. very active organizations. And if you're watching anything in the news, you see that the Hamas, Hezbollah, and Islamic Jihad all over the world are causing havoc, and we have them right up the road, and they are active here in the United States. We're working closely with our Muslim neighborhoods, working with them to get information, and I'll show you how that's working for us, why we need input from you guys. 41% of the time, suspicious activity actually triggered an event. So that's why we need information. Suspicious activity is all we're looking for. The non-conventional stuff, the guy that takes a picture of the water tower, or the picture of the front of your building, or something, and someone get a name, ask who he is, why, what they're doing, and we see if he's associated with any groups that we need to be worried about. Seven signs of terrorism. I'll skim over these. You have a handout on that. One being surveillance. We know that surveillance is very important in anything that we do, but terrorism is one that they use all the time, looking for targets. Elicitation is no more than stopping and asking for information, walking in your front desk downstairs and asking how many people work here. Is there a deputy sheriff available? How long are you open? When are you closed? Those type of things. So the second sign. Third sign is test of security. We know that the terrorists all over the world test security before they do something. We know that the everyday criminal, if he's going to walk into Walmart and shoplift, walks in to see if they have security before he picks something up. So this is very important that people are aware, all your county employees are aware that this is what they need to be looking for. Acquiring supplies. The people, the 7 or the 18 suspected terrorists in Canada that was arrested 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, were arrested because they were trying to acquire supplies. They actually were making comments about buying 3 tons of ammonia nitrate. They did buy 3 tons of ammonia nitrate from an undercover police officer. So we know that they're out acquiring supplies, and that's one thing they're going to do. The other thing with the thing in Canada, the 18 people, after they did the search warrants on their residence, they found firearms, and a lot of the firearms they found in Canada were purchased in the state of Ohio. Suspicious people who just don't belong, it's one of the things that you look for. And again, working with your people and through your office, have your county employees watching for this. Dry runs, we know that dry runs are something that happens on in this area all the time. They try to see how close they can get, how long it's going to take them to get from point A to point B, and if they can carry their mission out. And then deploying assets and getting into position. We know that this is the last thing that they're going to do, and if they get this far, something's definitely going to happen. We haven't stopped them. The only thing we can hope for is that in the previous 6 things that we actually have done something to slow them down or actually turn them away from the target they're looking for. Information analysis, this is one of the information analysis informations we use, programs we use to get our information into a graph that you can look at. Basic elements for any event, you have to have target equipment personnel. If you take one of these away, the event doesn't happen. It's the same thing as an arson. You have a place to burn, an accelerant, and someone to strike the match. Take one of those away, you don't have the arson. So we're looking to stop this from anything from happening here. Due to the fact of the targets and equipment and personnel, take one of those away. September 11th, and how did that impact Ohio of 2001? One of the ways was we were the center of, in Cleveland, was one of the control centers for one of the flights. The other was that actually 2 of the flights on September 11th of 2001 broke Ohio airspace. One of the flights, 77, which was going to Los Angeles from Washington, D.C., left Dulles. Came all the way out to Portsmouth, Ohio before it turned around and went back and slammed into the Pentagon. A lot of people think it just went out over Virginia, turned around and come back. It did not. It flew about 45 minutes west before it was turned around and went back. The other flight was Flight 93, flew to Cleveland, left Ohio just over Columbiana County, crashed into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. That flight was less than 8 minutes of flying time of being an Ohio incident. It was 70 miles from the border of Ohio to Shanksville, air miles. That plane crashed 7.81 minutes after leaving Ohio airspace. So that's the time that it could have been here and not there. Instead of a southwest Pennsylvania incident, it could have been a southeast Ohio incident. Vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, or better known as car bombs. 3 times it's happened in North America. People say it's not going to happen here. It's already happened here. In 82 in Canada, Toronto, 93, the World Trade Center the first time, and 95 when they blew up the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City. 77% of the time a sedan is used in car bombs. This is a cutaway version, a picture of the bomb that was used in the Khobar Towers back in 96 over in Saudi Arabia that killed some of our Air Force people. This was a sewage pumping truck. It went into the building on a regular basis. They checked it every day to make sure it was all right. They opened the hatch on top. This particular day, they had welded a 55-gallon drum inside the truck, filled that with sewage, and then filled the rest of the truck with 12 to 24,000 pounds of ammonia nitrate and ended up blowing the building up. This is a cutaway version of what one of the improvised devices might look like. This is made with C4 plastic explosives. The little white dots are nails, pieces of glass, those type of things, BBs that they can make into flying shrapnel. These are just four pictures. They're not showing up real good there, but the two on the left are actually of a school bus. The front bottom was the front view, and the top one's a back view. That was blown up with 2 pounds of ammonia nitrate, 2 pounds only. The other two are just training. They're all four trainings. One's a semi at the bottom and a ice cream truck at the top. London bombings of 07, or July 7th, 05, three of the four were actually British citizens. They were born there. They lived in a little town called Leeds. Leeds is actually about the size of Hamilton. And population heavily lower, middle class, blue collar workers work here, go somewhere else. These are three of the boys on the morning of the bombing. The first boy going through the door, the second boy with the white bag there and a white hat. They have their backpacks on. The person in the white shirt with the backpack is probably a tourist just going for a ride on the train that morning or going somewhere. Scotland Yards looked at 80,000 hours of videotape and found four times that these three individuals had gotten on this train. They had entered this train station. If you look at the time there, it's 7:21 in the morning, 7:07:05. This is a time frame of the bombings. After they entered the train station, they all got on four different apparatus, three different trains and a double-decker bus. 8:50, they set off three of the bombs. They were entered the train station at 7:21, 8:50, 8:50, 8:50. The 9:47 was a double-decker bus bomb, and not sure what that went off at that time for. It could have been a secondary device, or it could have been actually went off at the wrong time. They're not sure, because all four of those individuals died in the explosions. This is just a comparison of the timeline for the September 11th attack, 8:45 for the first plane, 9:03 that second plane. Down to bottom, 9:43, for the plane into the Pentagon that came all the way to Ohio, remember. And then the plane that crashed in Shanksville would have been back in Washington, D.C., its intended target, about 10 o'clock. So 15 minutes between both of those flights are very well timed. This is one of the bombers. This is the boy that was on the double-decker bus. They know that because his mother turned him in missing at 10:20. And then looking at evidence on the bus, they found that he was at the center of the explosion. 19 years old. By the way, these individuals in London were 19 to 22 years old. Another one of the bombers in London, this young man was 22. He'd graduated from Leeds Metropolitan University, come from a good family. His mother and father owned a chip and fish and chip shop. He was born there, and he was one of them at the Aldgate Station. We have an Ohio connection to the bombings, and that's one way we talk about this particular incident, is this gentleman here, Jermaine Lindsay, was in Cleveland, Ohio in 2000. He has relatives that live in Cleveland at the present time. His mother lives in the Cleveland area, and that's our Ohio connection. This boy chose to do something in London, luckily for us, and not in Ohio. Other Ohio data, we have Lindsay, we had Damara. He ran the largest mosque in Ohio. He was actually funneling money back to Islamic Jihad. He's been deported. He lived in Cleveland. We have three individuals that lived in Toledo. They are incarcerated right now. They were actually planning on joining insurgents in Iraq and also blowing up some places in the Toledo area. They lived in that little brick house. We all have little brick houses like that here in our own communities. These young men were actually turned in by their Muslim friends at the mosque they attended because they said they were getting a little radical and they didn't like it. They were also turned in by the people that lived beside them in the little brick house because they were paying attention to what was going on around them. That's why we need input from our public. We have Ayman Faris. Ayman was arrested in trying to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge. He was working with Al-Qaeda. He was living in Columbus. He was a truck driver. He had an Ohio driver's license with a hazmat endorsement. He had direct ties to Osama bin Laden. He actually made a phone call back to Al-Qaeda superiors, told them that the Brooklyn Bridge was too well fortified. A couple things going on there. One was that the bridge was being watched by the police department. The other was the cables were a lot bigger when he looked at them in person than they were when he saw them in a picture, and it was going to take more explosives than he realized. So he got picked up because he made a phone call, and the phone calls were being monitored at that time. Narandon Abdi is another individual living in Columbus, Ohio. He was Somalian. He was actually planning on blowing up a Columbus shopping center. He was working with other individuals. One of the individuals he was working with was Ayman Faris, the individual who wanted to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge. Ayman Faris picked Mr. Abdi up at the Columbus airport when he came to town. The only connection between those two is Al-Qaeda. We have Sheikh Mohammed. Sheikh Mohammed was the money man for the September 11th hijackings. He had a bad hair day there. He actually was picked up in United Arab Emirates. He was funneling money to the hijackers. He was also funneling money to Ayman Faris. This connection comes together like this. We have Ayman Faris, we have Mohammed, Sheikh Mohammed, we have Zarqawi, which we threw him in because he was one of the hijackers that had direct connections to Mohammed, all back to the guy with the beard. You look at Ohio in this way, Ohio is very important for a number of reasons. One of them is that we are the center of a population. If you leave Ohio and drive 8 hours in any direction, you can touch three quarters of the population of the United States. Just down the road from you here, over in Warren County, you have the Texas Eastern Pipeline Distribution Center. You have DHL Airborne Express down at Wilmington, Ohio, that flies 115 planes a night in and out of there in 4 hours that haul everything in the world. You have the interstate highway system that comes in and out of every place here and runs right through the middle of your county that travels millions of vehicles a year. We have the train traffic, the big train yards down in Cincinnati. We have a big train yard up in Huron County. The pipelines, as I said, all that in and out. We have the Air Force Base, those type of things around the state. We have the international terrorist. We have local domestic extremist groups, which is our 34 hate groups we have in the state of Ohio we worry about, some of them locally. We have, again, the domestic terrorist, the Earth Liberation Front, those people. We have gangs. Gangs are getting very prevalent in Ohio. MS-13, the Latin Kings, gangster disciples, those type of things. They actually caught gangster disciples just south of Columbus trying to set up at a high school for career day. I mean, these guys are very, very energetic on getting people to sign up with them. Motorcycle gangs, and then that's it. And that's basically what we need is input. And what I'm looking for is just a buy-in from you guys to say, good job. We'd like to get you interested and hooked up with some of our other agencies here in the county and let you know what we're doing. So when you see that, you know, you see the posters around. The posters I give you are actually the ones that we're working with your EMA director and your sheriff and your police chief and your fire chief here in the communities to get the information out to the public. That we just need information. And the more information we get, the better off we are and the better we can protect our public. That's it, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Well,
thank you very much, Tom. And yes, Chuck?
Bill, have anything?
That's what I was going to ask. Bill, would you have anything to add, or Utah?
Tom's been down several times getting some of the workshops in the bill. He and I have crossed past numerous times out in the States. It's very interesting program. Maybe some of
Thomas, very interesting presentation, and you know, we all hope that Ohio doesn't get touched at all. But we know that that's a you know, putting our heads in the sand if we believe that. So we all have to be vigilant, because you know, you think, well, it's never going to happen here, but that's, you know, and then it does, and we always want to be prepared and vigilant, and we thank you for your service to Ohio.
Well, thank you. Thank you for letting me know. I got applications here. I'll leave each one an application for Sims. All you have to do is fill it out and fax it back to Mary Tyler, and Mary will get you guys signed up, and you'll be able to get information on a regular basis on Homeland Security issues geared towards the commissioners and towards you.
You, okay. Or Bill, you guys signed up with Sims?
Bill, yeah, Bill gets it.
Do Utah?
Utah doesn't. I don't.
Okay, great.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Do we have anyone else who would like to address commission this time? Yes, sir.
Morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
My name is Richard Blevins. I live at 8126 Keister Road. I'm here because I've had almost a four-year problem with an adjoining property, 8146 Keister Road. The guy that owned the property before built a pond with a levee that encroaches on my property. I've talked to several departments about it. In Butler County. One of those was Soil and Conservation, Jennifer Deaton. She called the pond a nuisance, said basically to a paragraph sent to me that it was a nuisance and it should be filled in. I've talked to Madison Township trustees about the problem. During a foreclosure, the guy went bankrupt after doing this damage. He went bankrupt, and I talked to the loan company trying to get the problem resolved. I presented a letter to the court here in Butler County during the foreclosure. Judge Spaeth, I talked to him personally. His comments was, is his best interest that the loan company take care of the problem. I have these documents here that I'd like to present to you if I can.
And the loan company is out of state, right?
California,
right,
yes. Yes.
I remember reading you sent us a letter.
Yes, yes.
About this. And
I just need help. I really do. I've had in 4 years things that I've had to address that I don't want to. I'm here, I don't want to be. I think the health department has failed me. The property that was foreclosed on was told by me with a letter certified that the septic system was failing, was in violation. Two violations sent in 2003, one just recently in May. I've had the sheriff department there as of May of 2006 to verify what I'm here for. And he wrote this down, mosquito problems, sewage problems are running onto my property. Actually, what happened was I even sent certified letters to the health department and also the loan company, and Madison Township instructed me to do so, and also the zoning over the pond issue. Well, as it stands now, nobody's done anything for me, basically meaning I have recently had a soil test. The soil showed definitely that I have sewage on my property from the adjoining property, not mine, but from there.
Who owns the property right now?
Chris Landry.
Okay. And he, does he live there?
Yeah, this is what is a kicker. Everybody, loan company, the court here in town, Madison Township trustees, health department, zoning department, all knew that the property was in foreclosure. I sent directly a letter to Jeff Agnew, April the 8th, 2005, stating a mosquito problem, holes, which this guy claims it's a pond. It's not. It's a hole just dug, like a basement somebody abandoned. But it does have a levee, and that levee is on my property. It encroaches on my property.
And if I understand from what I remember reading the letter, and what struck me was the fact that this property was sold without these things being corrected.
Yes, sir. That's exactly that's, right.
To me, you know, and I was in real estate for a while, that you couldn't sell, you couldn't transfer a deed without having
exactly.
some clearances from, you know, the septic system and things like that. So I think our system did fail you.
You wouldn't believe the legwork that I have done in 4 years, almost 4 years, okay? I've talked to Bill Hobbs, the realtor. I presented two documents of violation for the septic tank before ever this guy signed a dotted line for buying the property. All right, I made it aware to him before it was sold, okay? This guy gets a hold of Scott Wilson with the health department at the time, before he bought it. Scott Wilson was supposed to have told him, and he told me, he said that he told him the septic tank leach line was in violation. That should have been end of story, that right. The health department should have not let him occupy the house until it was fixed, okay? I have the documents here that of violations in 2003, twice. He had to go to court in 2003 over the same thing. And also, I've got a copy of the violation of May the something of this year. Violation again, and it's never been fixed to this date.
What I've talked to Mr. Blevins, and I will say that Mr. Blevins has been an extremely professional, kind, and patient over this thing. And I think basically the county or the government has failed to step up and really help him solve his problem.
I thank you for that.
Yeah, I think the building and zoning department, I've gotten them looking back at the pond to see if we can really pin down that it's a pond that was not put in appropriate or legal, then we can take some legal actions to try to cure that situation. But this is one of those cases that has all these little dips and doodles, and it's just not one agency involved with it. So I've been doing some research into it.
What bothers me is that the Department of Health would
yes.
okay the transfer of the property, knowing
right,
that
right.
the septic system is in violation.
Right.
I don't know how.
Do they have to okay occupancy?
Well, I don't know how a loan company
right.
lends the money out knowing that this is in violation.
Here's how the problem affects me. Naturally, odor. All right. Then you got the health issue. And then resale of a brand new house. I've got a house that's a year old.
Yeah.
Now I've got all these documents. How do I put my place on real estate?
Because you got
how do I do that?
Stuff, yeah.
That's where the health department's failed me.
Yeah. Right.
Because, you know, I have to answer to that. And the way I look at it now, the health department should answer to me.
Yeah.
Because I got the sewage. I got proof of it.
Yeah.
I sent the stuff off, had it analyzed, and definitely it's on my property.
I thought maybe one thing that might be a next step is trying to get everybody together in one meeting at his place. And
I'd like to see the place.
Yeah, and maybe I can get a commissioner to attend. And
that would be great.
And see if we can get somebody off the dime when we have everybody together.
I'll welcome you with open arms.
Okay, I'll try to get that set up for next week.
Okay.
But do we have the authority to tell the new owner of the property, you must have this fixed, and what is our remedies?
Well, right now, the health department, my understanding is the health department has given them instructions and issues edicts or whatever to do an above ground aerobic system. But
right.
The problem with that is that it discharges into the pond.
Right.
And I think one of our solutions is if we can determine that the pond was put in illegally, we can order the pond filled in and all that kind of stuff, and then he has to do a different type of sewer system that would solve the issue.
Probably a mound system or something of that nature, or go to the road like a lot of other people, is their system is on the road.
Oh, is there sewer out there?
No, the discharge goes to the ditch.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I might add this. Jennifer Deaton with the Soil and Conservation people has been very helpful with me. She sent me a lot of documents, and it's very clear in the documents that this guy has violated the pond issue drastically, meaning all the engineering, there is no engineering. It's a hole. But on the other hand, there's a levee for that hole that encroaches on my property that varies probably from this high to 3 feet, whatever, and probably 200 feet or better that extends onto my property. She said that it's a nuisance and should be filled in. Madison Township trustees, all three, were on my property, seen what I'm trying to explain to you gentlemen. They said it's a nuisance, and it's a nuisance to children. All right. Also, in a building of ponds, it gives definitions of how it's supposed to be put in and by engineering and so forth. As far as zoning, I think zoning can be involved in that because the word structure with a dictionary can be anything. All right. It's not a building made out of wood. That's called, you can probably help me there, but that's another structure. But the structure I'm talking about is a structure that can be made out of anything. I've got the zoning book back there, but anyway, it's in there. And also the Madison Township trustees called it a nuisance also. And I have a copy of that in here also.
Is the prosecutor's office involved at all?
Well, I thought maybe we'd get somebody from the prosecutor's office too. That's a good idea.
Let's see if we can get something that we can sink our teeth into.
Can I present this to you?
Certainly.
Do you have copies for yourself?
Yeah, I've got more of a file.
All right, okay. So we can keep these?
Yeah, you can.
All right, thank you. Well, I'll work on getting a meeting. I'll call you later today or tomorrow. We'll see to pinpoint who all do we think we need to have at this meeting. And then we'll get something set.
Thank you.
And you're welcome.
We apologize you had to go through this, because I really do think that we've failed you as a government.
That'd be okay if I can get it taken care of.
I understand.
Thanks.
Yep. Thank you.
Executive
session. Just recess?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Candace, do you have anything? Okay. We will recess for executive session.
Candace, did you get the information from the mental health board?